So good morning, everyone, and thank you for coming. Actually, this weekend there's been going on a retreat for in our community, which is known as our transmission Dharma transmission group. Why don't they stand up so you can kind of see who they are? So could everybody in the Dharma Transmission Group just stand up and I'll explain who they are? So you have a face. And there are actually a few more that couldn't be here this weekend. So these are people, for those of you in our community, these are people in our Dharma Transmission Program. Now you can be seated. So let me explain for those of you who don't know what that is. Basically, several years ago, this is actually year two for the program, there was a felt need in our community because of its growth and development, that even though the Dharma teachings and practices have been presented for many years now, it had never been done in a very systematic way, targeted to a specific group of people, and it was felt moving forward for the future of our community, that was important to have a group of people that are more deeply trained in the Dharma, so to speak, in the teachings and the practices. So about a little less than 2 years ago, I put out a letter to our community about this five-year Dharma transmission program and what it was going to be about. And set forth the criteria. Some of the criteria was they had to be willing to devote 2 hours a day, an hour of meditative practice and a matter of study. They had to be involved in four retreats, these weekend retreats a year, monthly colloquiums and teas and individual practice opportunities. They had to go on solitary retreat for 5 to 7 days a year. And they had to be under 60. Because we're looking to the future. And even though we have many wonderful people here in our 60s and in the 60s and 70s who are really functioning as key roles in our community, We were looking, you know, down the road. And because we are often here teaching here in permanence, and we know that old age and death comes to everyone, we have to plan accordingly, that our current generation, including myself, will not be here forever. So we are now in our second year, and we have a curriculum, a curriculum of study and practice, sort of what everybody is following, and so therefore, part of the focus for these past months, and the focus for this retreat, has been on, let me just say Buddhist psychology. For those of you who have an interest in Buddhist teaching, it has to do with what's called the Yogacara school of Buddhism, and Vasubandhu, this wonderful Indian Buddhist teacher from the 3rd or 4th century. So his teachings on the 30 verses, many commentaries on it. So that's what we've been up to this weekend, and it's still ongoing through today. But I want to talk with you a little. Yes, you can't hear me. There are special hearing devices. They're all gone. Can I do something with this? Can we do our best? Is this any better? Is this any better? Can't hear. I don't know. What? What? Switch places, I should go back there? What? I'll probably come up here. All right, they're making arrangements back there. So we understand the process of aging. So, again, we are a very psychologically oriented society. Many of you here are here because you are psychologically oriented. People, when they have emotional issues, behavioral issues, relationship issues, they go to a psychologist or a therapist. So, you know, in our world, our current world, psychology and psychological healing is very present. And we often think that way. We relate that way. We talk that way. Well, please understand that before there was psychology and psychiatry, there was Buddhism. And what these Buddhist teachers and masters and meditators have been up to for 2,600 years is looking at the same exact thing that modern-day mental health people look at, which is, you know, why do people suffer? And how to remediate that suffering so people can be healthy and happy and lead fulfilling lives, okay? And so this is what Buddhism is about. So oftentimes modern day people call the Buddha the great psychologist, you know? and very much the Buddhist teaching is a psychological teaching. But it looks at the mind and experience very differently than Western psychology, right? So it is important, I think, for those of us, and very insightfully, who are interested in healing and transformation in our lives, understand the psychology that's really behind meditation, that's behind mindfulness. So you understand the context of what you are doing. Is that clear? Because for most of us, we live sort of, we might say, from here up. Okay? And that is the way we relate to life. We see, we hear, we smell, we taste, we feel, sense in our bodies. Those are the five senses of the body, right? But if you think about it, how do you know the world? I mean, how do you even know there's a world out there? You see it, you hear it, you smell it, you taste it, and you feel it, right? I mean, those are the windows to life. And we're all human beings, that's what we do, right? Those are the five senses, and they all have their individual function, right? Eyes only see. They don't hear. They don't smell. Ears don't taste. Okay? I mean, I'm going simply, but please understand. So we have these five senses, and they're all just endlessly what? Bringing in sensory information, right? But again, the only reason we're even here today is because you can see me, hopefully you can hear me, you know, and you drove here. It's all sensory, okay? So the major way that we relate to life is through our five senses. Just nod your head so I know that you're with me, okay? And I'm serious, because if I do lose you along the way, because we're going to go on a little journey today, all right? But the journey is into this. Okay, this meaning just what's really going on right now, okay? So, you know, we all know we're here because we have five senses. Is that clear? That kind of grounds us in some kind of reality. Now, there is in Buddhism a sixth sense, and this is called it's mind consciousness, but it has a specific meaning, okay? So, we also have this capability of thinking. Everybody know what I'm talking about? Thinking. And we think about the things that our eyes, ear, nose, right? That's the stuff we think about, right? You don't think about anything else. You've had to have seen it, heard it, smelled it, tasted it, or felt it to think about it. Okay? So your five senses can only do what they do. But the mind consciousness is much more significant because it cannot only think about the things it wants to, it can think about anything that's going on in the five consciousnesses, the sense consciousnesses. Okay, just keep nodding your head or shaking your head. So this thinking mind, right, is very beneficial. It helps us, you know, hold a job. It helps we think about things, we analyze, we plan, right? It has very good functions, right? Is everybody clear? So that's kind of the upper level of the mind, right? We sense and we think. Where's the problem? Why are we here today? If it was that simple. See, there's something else going on here, isn't it? Right? Like issues. Like stuff. Like the past. Like, you know what I'm talking about? Okay. Now, what the Yogacarans tried to understand, you know, where is that? Because that, like, I can be aware of my five senses, I can know the world through my five senses, and I can be aware of my thoughts and my feelings and my perceptions, my emotions, right? But like, where are these issues coming from? Where's this stuff coming from? Where's this anger coming from? Where's this fear coming from? Where's this love coming from? Where's, you know, it seems to be coming from somewhere deeper. Deeper meaning we're not conscious, but all of a sudden it's there. Is that clear? Okay. So the tools of meditation were used to look more deeply into the mind. Because it also, again, these were not research psychologists, okay? These were Buddhist practitioners. So they were doing this in the context of a spiritual path. Because the goal of the spiritual path is to awaken, to be liberated from suffering, liberated from delusion, right? To only have wholesome qualities in the actions of body, speech, and mind, and to free ourselves of all the unwholesome ones, right? So everyone here might have noticed, why is it that even though you read the spiritual texts, even though you listen to the spiritual talks, even though you talk with your friends about spiritual matters, and even though you set your intention or aspiration to live a different life, right? Why is it that 5 minutes after setting that intention or aspiration, you're still living the same way? Right? Well, you get up in the morning, today I'm going to be mindful. Right? I'm going to be mindful all day. I read it, I heard it, sounds great. I had a few seconds of it in my meditation. I'm going to be mindful all day. You know, and 3 hours later, you remember what? See, I knew I forgot something, right? See, the Yogacarans were saying, why does that happen? You see? You know? And what they noticed was that with these six consciousnesses, the five senses, and this mind-thinking consciousness, that they are consciousnesses that are interruptible, right? So in other words, I'm looking at you, right? And I'm seeing, but I close my eyes. What happens? I don't see you anymore. My seeing is interrupted, right? My hearing can be interrupted, right? So in other words, if I can be looking and not paying attention to what my ears are hearing or what I'm smelling or tasting. Is that clear? So all the senses are interrupted, as well as we go to sleep. When we go to sleep, what happens? All our senses stop functioning, at least consciously, right? As well as thoughts are coming and going. Anybody notice that? Everybody's here, everybody here was meditation this morning. What did you notice about your thoughts? Continuous, same thought? No, coming, going, coming, going. Right? So the thinking mind also is constantly subject to interruptions, right? The biggest interruption we might think in our life is when we go to sleep, right? Let's say we sleep 8 hours, no thinking for 8 hours. And then when we wake up in the morning, we start thinking again, right? And all of a sudden we start remembering what? What do I got to do today? We remember the drama we were concerned about the day before. We remember that one. You see, but the Yogacarans go, well, where was all that when I was sleeping? That all of a sudden it comes up again, right? Or all of a sudden you're going somewhere and you've made a vow. I am not going to be angry at this person again, right? Anybody ever make that intention? I'm going to stop saying angry things to them. I'm going to start saying, unkind things, right? Everybody here ever make that intention? And what happens? Right? Like that. You're back into it. Well, where was that anger during all those times when you haven't been angry? Did you see what I'm saying? Can you think this is a very practical issue they were dealing with? Okay, where is all this stuff? And the other big thing was the sense of I, right? Everybody has this sense of I, me, my body, my life, my past, my future, my issues, my hopes, my dreams, my fears, right? My, I. We have an I, right? Well, where is that based? You see what I'm saying? Like, where does that come from? Again, I sleep. When I wake up, the eye resumes itself. You see? Or you go into a coma. Let's say or you faint, right? And when you're fainting, you're totally unconscious, right? None of your senses, you're not thinking anything. And then when you awaken from your fainting or you awaken from your coma, you just resume it. You just resume your life, right? You resume your identity. Right? You don't come out of your coma and go, wow, it's been blank for the last 30 days. I can just be whoever I want to be. Right? You don't wake up in the morning after sleeping a good 8 hours, your mind wakes up, you're totally fresh, and you go, who do I want to be today? What kind of past do I want to have? Why not? Why do we get up in the morning and resume the same role we've always played? Can you see? So this is going like, with an understanding, this, it must be somewhere in my mind. Unless you believe in gods or other things that are controlling you and programming you or aliens. If you don't believe in that, then you have to believe that somehow it's in my mind, right? It was a very interesting... So you see, these early Buddhist Indian practitioners were scientists, you know what I mean? They were researching, issues and trying to, find the answers, but they were scientists of the mind. They were looking in the mind. And they used the mind itself and the powers of the mind to understand. Is that clear? So what they discovered, and this is very important for all of us, is that there is a deep, relatively unconscious area of the mind that they called the Alaya Vijnana. It's often translated as the storehouse consciousness. So the question is, where's all this stuff stored? Right? That comes up. And if everybody sit in meditation, what do you notice comes up as you're sitting there? What came up this morning? What kind of things come up? What? A memory pops up. Just pops up. What else pops up? An issue resolved. You're sitting there. This wasn't your plan this morning to come in and meditate on your unresolved issues. Right? But you see what I'm saying? All of a sudden it comes up. All of a sudden a memory from your past comes up. All of a sudden, what else comes up? An emotion just comes out of nowhere. Things to do today. Right? And on and on and on and on. And then it goes and something else comes up. Well, where's all this stuff coming from? We never even ask these questions, do we? We think this is just the way it is. Okay? So these meditators, masters, asked the question. And what they discovered was there is this part of the mind that is actually the biggest part of the mind. Actually, in one of the texts we've been reading, it described the storehouse consciousness. Anybody know an eggplant? I think a big one. And on top of the eggplant, there's that kind of crown. And then, that's up here. And then the eggplant's like this. Well, the crown is our upper six consciousnesses. Okay? The eggplant is our storehouse. And what they discovered was that every action that we do of body, speech, and mind leaves an impression or a seed in the storehouse. And this is important to understand, especially for those of us who want to transform. This is why getting it up here, and many of us who are here today, we kind of get it. We get the spiritual path. We get the practices. We get all the reasons why it's good to be kind and not be unkind. And it's not good to be angry. And it's good to be loving. And it's not good to be judgmental and critical. And it's good to be accept, right? We get it up here. But why doesn't it manifest immediately? Right? I read the book. Shouldn't I? Right? I set the intention. Doesn't that mean from now on? Why do people find themselves often disappointed in themselves, frustrated, right? Because they get it here. Remember the eggplant? They get it here. But this is the repository of our past, of everything we have thought. Said, it's all left a little seed. It's all left a little impression. And that impression and seed will continue, according to the Yogacarans, forever, unless something else happens. Okay. Now, this storehouse consciousness with all these seeds of our past experiences and conditions and everything is a dynamic process. As you notice in meditation, right? Things are coming up, coming out. Things are coming up. We are continually, we're in process, we're alive, we continue to think, feel, and act, and read, and all the things we do, and as well as all this stuff from the past, and that's putting more seeds down. We're doing that constantly during the day, as well as all the old seeds are coming up, and whether we act on them or don't act on them, it has something to do with how the seeds then go back down. So this is a constantly interactive process. Seeds rising, seeds going back down, and there is this process of what's called perfuming. Perfuming, you understand the concept of perfuming. Perfuming or cologning. When somebody is wearing a strong perfume, what happens? The whole room can smell, as well as the perfume can get into the what? Clothes, right? And if somebody hugs you or something who's heavily perfumed, it gets into your clothes. So there is also this thing that the seeds are perfuming us. They're perfuming our unconscious. So it's not just a seed, but also it becomes like a disposition, you see. It's like, I was saying this to the people yesterday, it's like, why is it? Let's say somebody does something, or somebody doesn't do something, and we are resentful. We're a little irritated. We can even be a little angry, hurt. Everybody with me? Okay. Now, why does that very quickly become a total indictment of that other person? And all of a sudden, you're thinking about how terrible they are and all the terrible things they've done, and you're remembering every fault that they ever had. Right? Everybody know what I'm talking about, how quickly it spreads. That is this sense that they are kind of interconnecting with each other and perfuming each other. Right? So it very quickly kind of spreads like a perfume. Right? Somebody with a strong perfume comes into the room and the whole room smells. Okay? So in a certain sense, that even though we've only put down kind of an angry seed from that situation, it begins to perfume other seeds, and all of a sudden other things start coming up. And this is, again, you know, when I use words, it's not really like that. You see, it's very quick, it's immediate. We don't even know what's happening. Anybody ever the experience of going, I can't believe, you know, just like people say, just like that, I was angry. Just like that, I was hurt, right? Just like that, I was scared. You know, it's like, We don't even know where it's coming from. You know, we feel like swept away. Well, now you understand where it's coming from. Okay, it's coming from your storehouse consciousness. Okay? Well, we'll talk about this. Now, there's one other very important piece that they also discovered or were concerned about. And this is, there seems to be something in our mind that says, I am the one in control of all this. All this belongs to me, is happening to me. Right? And so this part of the mind that's sort of in between the upper levels and the lower levels is called manas. Manas, M-A-N-A-S. And manas is the sense of self, right? Manas looks toward your storehouse consciousness and everything in it and says what? That's me. Right? That all belongs to me. It looks up at the 6-6, at the 5 sense consciousnesses and the thinking consciousness and says, what? This is me. It all belongs to me. Right? Now, in Buddhism, psychology, this manas, this sense of self, this self of self-identity, this part of ourselves that makes everything about itself, is the culprit in our suffering, is the major culprit. Because self, ego, whatever you want to call it, is only concerned about one thing. What? itself. Have you noticed that? If you happen to get into a relationship to somebody, and this is just very private, nobody has to publicly disclose, have you noticed that in your relationship with other people, your primary concern is what? Anybody willing? All right, do you want me to say it for you? Is me. My happiness. Are my needs getting met? Are my desires getting met? Are things going the way I want them to go? Are people acting the way I want them to act? Isn't that true? Yeah. Right? As we go through our day, if you really attend to your inner dialogue, what is he or she concerned about all day?
Me.
Right? Right? I mean, you're not concerned about other people's to-do list, are you? No. You're only concerned about, how am I doing on my to-do list? We're not going, I wonder if I can help anybody else today with their to-do list. It's just, how am I doing with my to-do list? How am I doing in this conversation? People thinking I'm smart? How am I looking? Okay, go check the mirror quick. How am I looking, Can you see? It's a chronic situation. This manas is also called the grasping mind. It's always grasping. It's always attaching. It's always wanting. It's always needing. Is that clear? And so what happens, remember the storehouse? And again, I'm just making a picture. See, in this movement up and down of all these seeds, manas is in the middle. It's all filtering through self. Right? So self is distorting the way we think, because the way we think becomes self-centered thinking. Right? It's all about me, I, me, mine. What's in it for me? How am I doing? Do they like me? Am I successful? Why didn't I get the promotion? Why don't I have this? Why do they have that? Which brings up the other point is, if there's a me over here, then everything I see and perceive is external to me. So I feel disconnected. I feel separate. I feel alone. The I feels very lonely. Right. And so it's always trying, it's insatiable in getting its needs met. Has anybody noticed that there's a problem in life? That no matter how many needs of the self, of the ego, we meet, has anybody ever noticed that it's never enough? It's never enough for the ego. It always wants more. It always needs more. Why is that? Because it doesn't really exist in any real way. The only way it can prove it exists is by keeping us occupied, fulfilling its needs. I often see manas the Wizard of Oz. Right, you remember that great scene at the end, remember the great and terrible Oz, and he's got this, gigantic face and this strong voice and this smoke, and, remember him? And all of a sudden, Toto? Exposes that behind that imperious, demanding, right, ordering about, wizard is what? It's all smoke and mirrors. Behind it's a little, remember, he's a little old guy, And you remember when he realizes that they can see him? Remember that scene? It's all over. Of course, this is what meditation's about. Okay. But that's very much like that. We have this manas within us that is endlessly demanding, endlessly issuing commands to us, you know, endlessly concerned and worried about itself, keeping us hopping all day, all night, when we wake up in the morning, and it's never satisfied. So that is why it is unfortunately a normal human condition these days to not feel at ease, to not feel a deep sense of ease within oneself, to not feel whole, to not feel complete, to feel again separate and alone and lonely. Even right, they talk about, you know, loneliness in the crowd. You know, even in the midst of the crowd, even in the midst of relationships, it's never enough, is it? How many times in relationships do people feel unloved, right? And they want whoever they're with to what? Prove to them that they're loved. Right? Well, why is that? Manas, never satisfied. Needy, needy, needy. Needy, needy, needy. So, manas is this unconscious part of ourselves that's running the show. And unfortunately, as I said, the show, because it's a clinging, it's an attaching, and it's a deluded consciousness, it's only creating problems for us. It is the source of our suffering. And it is the understanding why, for those of us who have practiced, who have read, have studied, and have wondering, why does it still, even though there have been some positive changes, why does it still, on a day-to-day, moment-to-moment basis, still feel pretty much the way it always has been? Does everybody know what I'm talking about? You see? And now you know the answer. Because we've been working the transformation up here. And the real problem, I mean, part of the problem is up here. But the real problem, you know, that which is really running the show is all here. In our storehouse consciousness and in our sense of self, the manas. Manas, Thich Nhat Hanh calls manas the lover. Manas is in love with itself. It's in love with its creations. It's in love with its thoughts. It's in love with its needs. Right? It's in love with itself. I was saying to somebody yesterday, you know, we talk in our community about the cultivation of the four immeasurables of loving kindness and compassion, you know. And I said, you know, we already are practicing these things. Don't say you don't know how to do it, but you're practicing them. We're all practicing them for ourselves, right? We all care about that our needs get met, right? We're all very supportive of our own needs getting met. And we're all very committed to ending our suffering, even at the cost of causing suffering to someone else, but that's immaterial. But we're all very committed. So we are already practicing, you know, these teachings on love, but it's a self-love. It's narcissistic. We love ourselves. We're concerned about our own well-being at the expense of others. We care about our own goals, our own objectives, and we don't care about others. Now again, there are obviously degrees of this, right? There are some people who this is not so extreme. They're more selfless, less selfish. There are people that are more self-centered, egocentric. You know, we have terms like this. Is that clear? So it's a continuum, but the continuum is all on the self. Is this all clear? I mean, this is very profound, but I think the key thing is to have a working knowledge of how Buddhist psychology sees the mind helps us understand how the process of transformation has to occur. And to again clearly understand that as long as the teachings is at the level of intellectual, conceptual, intermittent kind of practice, it will never get below here, much below here. It doesn't mean through changing the way we're thinking about things we cannot get some change. But the problem is the seeds of every, you know, egocentric, miserable, unhappy, angry, sad, judgment, you know, the seeds are within us. And they will last forever. Whatever you conceive forever is. Unless what? Unless they're transformed. Somebody who's on the path is somebody who is deeply transforming their storehouse consciousness. They are making sure that from now on, they are only putting wholesome things in their storehouse. Okay. I used the analogy yesterday with somebody, you know, it's like if you had a garage, right? And you've just been filling it, you know, you just were one of these compulsive people who go to garage sales, you know, and you've just been filling the thing with junk. You know, which is primarily what you find at garage sales, right? Somebody else's junk, right? And, you know, you don't really need it, but it was a good bargain. So you bring it home, and where do you put it? In the garage, all right? And over the years, you now have what? A garage storeroom filled with junk. Garbage. Right? You see? And then one day you go through a process where you learn about there are things of higher quality. Right? So you change. From now on, I am not going to go to garage sales. I'm going to go to estate sales. And I'm going to buy things of higher quality. Right? So you now have higher quality objects. And now you're beginning to put them in your garage, right? Now, unfortunately, and this is what many of us are doing, we're going, well, I am making some changes. You know, I am being a little kinder, a little nicer, a little more patient, right? And those are creating, right? Those are good seeds, right? And they're going down there into our storehouse consciousness. But we think, or we don't realize, right? It's like putting four estate sale quality objects into a garage filled with thousands of pieces of junk does not really significantly change the quality of what's in the garage. Is that clear? So this is our problem, you see. This is why we often get frustrated. We go, well, I'm really changing, you know, I'm trying to be kinder, I'm trying to be more patient, and right? Why does this stuff still kind of really run me? It's because we have not understood that the transformation has to go at this deeper level. Is that clear? Is it a little warm in here? It may be just lower the... We have a lot of people. celebration of the AC. I'm drinking some hot tea. You know, in the Buddhist teaching going back thousands of years, there is always this key saying that says, and you've probably heard me say it many times, goes back to the Buddha, you know, hear the teachings, reflect on the teachings, then practice the teachings. Okay? And this is talking exactly to what we're talking about, right? When we hear the teachings, when we read the teachings, when we listen to the teachings, it's here, okay? Now that's good. I mean, that's where it begins. So, you know, the fact that we have a self-reflective mind and an analytical mind and a reflective mind, the sixth consciousness, is good. You know, let's use it in a good way, all right? So, first, we hear, we read, and we think about a little bit these teachings, these practices. They make sense. Now, then the Buddha says we need to reflect. Reflect is like contemplate. It's like deeper. You know? I read about impermanence. You know, I read about sickness, old age, and death comes to everyone. Well, what does it really mean for me? That's my trajectory. I'm going to age, I'm going to get sick, and I'm going to die. You see? And everybody in my life, the same thing's going to happen to them. And it's going to happen to everyone. You know, what is it? What is the, you see what I'm saying? This is like a deeper reflection, contemplation. It's beginning to get down into that place where we have a lot of our mistaken beliefs about life. And that's just one example, that one really begins to contemplate and reflect on impermanence. Or in the way that I talked about ego and self-centeredness. You know, that one really, when one hears the teaching today or reads about it, their ego, self, and one goes home and really reflects, is that true? And really looks at oneself and one's life and one's mind. You know, is that true that my life is dominated and has been dominated by this sense of me that stands apart from everything else and everything is about me? I often say to people, try having an afflictive emotion without a sense of self. You can't do it. If there's not an I standing opposed to you, there's no way that anger could arise. There's no way that fear could arise. These things only arise because of a strongly held sense of self. So we reflect, we contemplate this. So it makes sense to us. So then, and you see, this is the reflecting piece is deeper. You see, it's like here it's just a thought or a couple of thoughts. Here it maybe begins to become a philosophy of life. It's like deeper. It's like something that now I'm referring to, right? A way that I'm kind of looking at life, approaching life, that kind of begins to make sense to me and also begins to guide me, right? It's deeper than just a passing thought, right? And then the Buddha said, hear the teaching, reflect, contemplate on it, and if it makes sense to you, then practice. And it is only, practice is about the transformation of the storehouse. It is about making sure that from now forward, I am doing my best to only put wholesome things into my storehouse. Because I'm going to be very mindful and aware in terms of the actions of my mind, my thoughts, my feelings. I'm going to be very aware of the effects of my words and be very aware of my actions. Because I know, even if nobody sees them, you know, in the privacy of my own home when no one's looking, in the privacy of my own mind that nobody can see. I am continually putting seeds and impressions. I am perfuming my storehouse. Everybody has one. Okay? That's what we're doing. And when we understand that, that we have this storehouse consciousness, we understand that I need, if I want to transform, if I want to feel different, I want to just have a sense of openness and fearlessness and loving-heartedness and compassion. And, you know, if I want to just have a, I need to change this. And I change this by cultivating a whole repertoire of wholesome, right? Actions of body, speech, and mind, as we say. And as well, probably even more important, I have to understand that this storehouse consciousness is a dynamic process and that it is continually affecting me. It's continually conditioning the actions of my body, speech, and mind, so it will continue to arise. It's not going to stop just because I came to a Dharma talk today or committed myself to the Buddhist path or whatever path. It's not going to stop. It is a constantly active process. But if we are on the one hand putting these new elements into it continually, and then when this old stuff arises, as it will arise, continually will arise, you can be sure of that. That is just the way the mind functions. It's not like anything is wrong with you. There are many people think something's wrong with them. No, this is just the way it is. We are the product of our conditioning. So when it arises, in Dharma we say, practice begins with the second thought. Is that clear? The first thought just comes up, right? Is it, you know? It's not like you set about to get hurt or angry or sad or scared. You know what I mean? It's just, boop. Okay. But if you are now cultivating a meditative life and you're cultivating mindfulness and concentration, now what you can do is what? You can be aware. Anger has arisen in my mind. Anxiety has arisen in my mind. Despair has arisen in my mind. Frustration has arisen in my mind. Resentment has arisen in my mind. Critical thinking has arisen. You know what I mean? You're now aware of it. You label it. And you know it's what? Unwholesome. So mindfulness also implies we have a criteria now. We know what to be mindful of. We're mindful of the unwholesome and the wholesome when they arise. So we can't stop them from arising. This is not about repression or suppression. But what we can do is when they arise, right? First thought we can't control. The question is, and this is important, people understand, as practitioners, practice begins with how you relate to whatever is arising. We can't control the arising. Many people think spiritual life is about controlling everything. Got to control this mind of mine. Got to get rid of this stuff. Right? You know? People talk like that, you know? It's almost like they want to shoot themselves or at least shoot that part of their mind. How do I get rid of, you know, that thing? But you know what I'm talking about. So it's not like that. It's like when it arises, no matter what it is, that is afflictive, that is unwholesome. You see it, you're aware that it's arising, and then you do something different than you've done in the past. Is that clear? If you don't, if you just attach to it and go with it, things will never change. And that action, whatever you're doing in your mind or your speech, will then continue to go back down into your storehouse the way it came up, right? And if you really give it a lot of play, it could even go down stronger. Okay. if you want to transform, and what the Yogacarans talked about was that enlightenment is a process of transformation at the base. So we transform the base by being very conscious about putting only quality things in from now on, right? And rather than getting rid of all the old stuff, we transform it. Because when it arises, now we are careful. We know it's arising. We don't give it any play. Or we do something different. Right? Rather than giving vent to anger, anger is based on not understanding. It's based on control and manipulation. Wanting things to be different. Wanting people to be different. Wanting people not to do what they're doing. Not to say what they're saying. Right? What if we replace that anger and that angry interpretation of what's going on with understanding? Such as what? That person is suffering. That's why they're doing that. They're suffering. Only a suffering person would say or do something like that. So we generate compassion. We generate understanding. You know, that person is the product of their causes and conditions just like me. They don't know better. Right? So we're more patient. We're more understanding. Right? So we've done what? On the one hand, we have not in any way given play or intensified the afflictive emotion, let's say of anger. But as well as we have cultivated what? Compassion, patience, understanding. Which goes down, down, right? It leaves its seeds. So can you see the dynamic process here? Over time, not tomorrow, not next week, but over time, if one practices in this way, mindfulness, concentration, insight. If one practices in this way, transformation at a deeper level begins to unfold. This is the path to awakening. This is the path to transformation that is more than just up here. Because this is, watch your mind, right? If you're in meditation and you watch your mind, what do you learn about your mind? Is it stable? Really something you can depend on. This is a real source of stability there. Is it highly discerning and intelligent, always wise? Well, it's filled with nonsense. That's at its most benign. But at its true, it's really just filled with all kinds of distorted ideas and self-centered thinking. It's, right? It's not a good friend, especially if you want to change. Because it only knows itself as it was in the past. You see, that's all it knows. Now again, this thinking, discerning, self-aware mind, this sixth consciousness, is also the one that helps us have the idea that there is another way. That the way I've been living has not been very satisfactory, has not been very beneficial. Right? So many people think, meditation, I got to kind of get rid of this thinking mind. You know, that's the problem. No. It's this thinking mind doesn't think clearly. We need to develop right thinking, clear thinking. We need to have thoughts that serve us, right? Serve our aspiration. Serve our desire to transform, to be of service, to be of help. To be a loving, wise presence in the world, in our families, in our communities, in our world. How are we going to do it? Through this process of transformation. I don't think, are there any questions? It's all simple stuff, isn't it? Yes. Well, hold on. I mean, communication, you should have been, there was a workshop here a couple of weeks ago. So this, the key piece here is we got to get our act together. You see? Right? At this point in life, for most of us, our only concern is getting everybody else's act together. Okay? Let's be honest here, right? You know, our mission in life is to get everybody straightened out. So they're, you know, so they're doing what we want, acting what we want, responding to us what we want, right? That's the truth. And if we're serious about transformation, we need to start looking here first, right? That's the difference between, let's say, someone who lives a truly spiritual meditative life and a worldly person. The worldly person sees the problem where? Out there. Why am I unhappy? Why am I screwed up? Why am I this? Why am I that? Because of you. Because of situations. Because of conditions. Okay. The truth is we are screwed up because our minds are screwed up. We're unhappy because unhappiness is arising in our mind. Anger is arising where? Somebody just said something. What's the big deal? I mean, where's the rage? There's no reason for rage. Somebody just did something, said something, didn't say something. The rage is coming from here. Now you know it's coming from your storehouse. Because your storehouse probably has a long history of when it's, you know, when it meets situations where people are not saying or doing what we want, it gets what? Angry. Angry, angry, angry. Hundreds of times, thousands of times. Strong seeds of anger in us. If you want to be free of anger, we need to look to where it's arising. And that's only in our mind. Right? If it wasn't in my mind, nobody could trigger it. People talk about triggers. Well, what's it triggering? Something within me. In my own mind. You know? And I think if I can just get rid of those damn triggers, right? Then what? Then I'll be happy. Right? If I can get rid of all those annoying, irritating people, then I'll be, you know. I mean, I'll be the calmest person in the world, right? It doesn't work that way. So good. We'll stop now. Yes. Just a quick one, because we're. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's another Dharma talk. The first step is to recognize what we have. Okay. Later on is to really go deeply more into the nature of what we have. But the important thing first is to understand we have this storehouse, we have this manas, and it's the source of our trouble. And understanding things more deeply is only in the service of facilitating at a deeper level that transformation. But the transformation also has, you know, I hate to tell it to you, but even if you're profoundly enlightened, you still got to clean your house. You still got to do the dishes, right? You still got to clean out the storage. It's filled with junk, right? Thich Nhat Hanh calls it garbage. We need to compost our garbage. If we don't compost our garbage, what happens? We'll end here.